Hello, and welcome to I Am The Egg Pods with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this bonus episode, I'm going to be talking all things Beatles with actor, stand-up comedian, TV host and podcaster, Greg Proops.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm well. I'm trying to keep it real, as they say, during the pandemic. I'm doing online comedy, which is good fun. And we're still doing Who's Line as a live show with Ryan Stiles and everything.
Yes. Who's Live
but
Anyway?
Who's Live Anyway? But it's not really the same. What can I tell you?
How does that work? Is it a Zoom thing or?
Right. We get everybody online on a Zoom thing. And then we have an audience do suggestions on the chat side. And then we do, you know, improvs and stuff. But mostly it's turned into riffing and spieling, which I think is the, you know, the best. We had Eric Idle on last show because he's mates with, well, we're all friendly with him, but he's Jeff Davis's mates with him. He did a show with him. And so we got Eric to do it and he was great fun. And then this week we got Lorraine Newman, who's was on the original Saturday Night Live here, and Drew Carey, our old buddy from the show. And so we're you know, someone wrote a brash group of youngsters, and I was like, give us a chance.
I have to say, my lockdown companion has been smartest man in the world, Proopcast.
Thank you, Chris.
Fortress of Prooptitude. I can't pronounce it, but it's been...
The Fortress of Prooptitude. Yeah, we're in it right now. This is the fortress.
We are. There's quite a... For people who can't see it, there's a surreal George Harrison fireplace-esque montage going on behind you.
There's Moroccan lamps, and that one's really from Morocco. There's modern art, a pinwheel that we got as a gift last 4th of July that we've kept because it's so horrible. There's nothing worse than patriotic gigas. I really hate that. So Jennifer kept that one too. There's also a Moroccan lamp above me that you can't see, and lots of mystical orbs and stuff.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so we try to keep some mood in here. I see a lot of people broadcast from, I don't like, you look like you're in a prisoner of cell block H. You have the books behind you there, and I don't know where your cellmate is.
This is where I've been working for the last year. It's the spare room.
I actually work in another area of the fortress, but we do a lot of the podcasting from this area because of the backdrop. And thank you for listening to the show. Jennifer's been fantastic. And basically, let me be honest, holding it together for the last few months because of my Bukowski-esque descent into complete incoherence. She's had a pretty tight handle on the agenda and what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And, you know, we try to keep it upbeat and talk about anecdotes and stuff because everybody knows what the situation is, you know. And my other big audience, obviously, is you guys about the series, The Archipelago, that includes Ireland and Sky. And so I don't have to tell you guys how crap Bojo is or why Michael Gove should be in jail or why, you know, that whole crime crew is as bad as ours, you know. So I feel for you guys. I really do, because I have so many friends over there.
Well, you lived over here, didn't you, for a couple of years?
I lived there for about 5 years in the 90s, which was an excellent time to live there because I lived there during Cool Britannia and all that jazz. We came over in like 93, and I think we moved there like the next year. So it was Blur and Radio 2 and... Mark Radcliffe and Katie Puckrick, whatnot, Hufty.
Yes, yeah.
There was all that youth TV and all that jazz. And
Britpop, primarily Oasis, took the lead in this, but you know, Beatles really came back into the fore in the 90s, exactly when you were over here. What sort of music were you listening to at the time?
Oh, that, you know, and also Beck and Aerosmith was huge in TV still then, and Stereo MCs. I liked the British soul that was going on in those days. There was a lot of great dance music in England. Also Mary J. Blige and George Michael, you know, pop was so on fire in England. And, you know, I remember buying the cassette of Shampoo. I bought the Spice Girls second album, I think, when I was in Dublin doing a gig. I mean, like, we were awash in pop music. The radio was on fire then, for real. And then everybody was just getting cable in London. So it was that kind of what happened in America 30 years before was sort of happening in England. And the Beatles, like you say, because Oasis was so obsessed with them and stole so much from them, and George was really mad at them at the time. Mm. And I remember having lunch with the head of Radio One, and we all were at this restaurant smoking in those days. And he told us that every single track on the Oasis album was contested and sued over, and that they settled on all of them. And four or five Beatles, T-Rex, a couple other groups, they just stole so many riffs that they were basically sued to death over the whole album and paid.
Yeah. So tell me, when did you, going back to your youth, when did you first discover the Beatles?
Oh, well, I'm exactly the right age. I watched them with my sister. My sister's 7 years older than me, so she's exactly the right age. She was like 13 or 14 when they came out here. I was 4 or 5. She's 7 years older than me, so she was like 12 or 13, which is exactly the right age.
Yeah.
So she would demand that we watch them on Ed Sullivan in black and white, which we did. And then fantastically, as I got to be like 5 and 6, there was a Beatles cartoon on television here.
Oh, yes. That
they had nothing to do with. Yeah.
Hollywood at last. Keep your eyes on me, chaps. I'm here to be discovered. Don't think it hasn't been fun working with you all, but now that I've made it to Hollywood, when they ask me to star in the next picture, I don't know if I'll be able to find a place for you. Hollywood, I'm here.
Didn't Ringo do that sort of...
They all talk like this.
Yeah.
It was really, like, just fantastical. Words, what do you think, George? Well, I don't know. And, I thought that cartoon was magic. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like when you're little, they played 2 or 3 Beatles songs in every episode.
Yeah.
So I remember Babies in Black and Penny Lane and all that. So I thought and the show started with boom, 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 boom. It's been a hard day. So when you're like 6, and then they were on TV, and I remember the very beginning of their popularity, it was really important to know all their names because they were kind of like the first group that was famous. In America, it was always like solo artists, you know, and especially coming off
lots of Cardigans
pop era. It was Bobby Rydell and Bobby Vinton and everybody named Bobby and Frankie. And then all the black groups were just getting huge, like the Miracles and the Temptations, the Supremes. And they hadn't, there was that race, like the Beatles and them, and also all the Philly groups. And then the Beatles were doing all the numbers of all the R&B groups, right? They covered the Miracles, they covered the Ronettes, the Marvelettes. So I remember having to know their names was really important to be able to acquit yourself and name all 4 of them and know which one was what. And then my sister would get the teen magazines that they were always on the cover of. And then because I'm this old, I'm 61, then all the spin-off groups, right? Like the Monkees. The Monkees started in like 66, which is like 2 years after Beatlemania. Mm. So it was still such an explosion that groups were copying the format of the Beatles, which is to say they had 4 cute guys and one of them was English. So when I was about 10, after the Beatles had broke up, I didn't see them. My sister didn't, but my friend Jeff Belton, who was also no longer with us, he saw them in 1965. His older sister Linda took him to see them at the Cow Palace. We drove by Candlestick Park on the last night because my father mentioned the Beatles were playing there that night, and I was familiar with the Giants baseball team because that's what they played.
Yeah.
And they would always be on Ed Sullivan. After they stopped touring, they would send Ed Sullivan videos. So I remember seeing Strawberry Fields, Penny Lane, Hello Goodbye. All of those were on the Ed Sullivan show, like MTV. He'd just show a video of the Beatles. They're the only people who got away with it.
Yeah.
And everybody liked it anyway. No one was bummed out. Everyone was like, oh, that's, you know, that's what they're doing now. They're not, you know, they're not available to show up, but they'll make this video for you.
We're just in it as drawings. And it's like us animated goes through it, you know.
But did Mystery Tour put you off making a film completely yourselves?
Yeah, we're only ever going to be cartoons forever now, because they really put us off those.
It's a new career piece.
No good damn critics.
My friend Jeff Belton and I, when we were little, were driven to go see Yellow Submarine. And on the poster outside, it said, something like 23 Beatles songs or something. Mm. And because I was a little kid, I was counting them and driving my friend Jeff crazy. So when we got to like the fifth number, I'd go like, that's number five. And he'd go like, will you shut up? And I kept doing it through the whole movie. And then there's that cute little part at the end where they come out and sing
All Together Now.
All Together Now, yeah. And I remember when I was a little kid thinking that was like the greatest. It's genius. How did they think of it? You know, to actually show up and go, hey, hello. Like yes. At the end of your movie, you know.
Yeah.
Then this compilation came out. One was red and one was blue. And the red one was the early years. And then the blue one was like the classic years. And it's like demarcation line is right around Revolver, I think. The psychedelic albums are the blue.
Yeah.
And then the last album. And then the other ones are all Beatlemania, Fab Four. That was sort of the weird grouping. But that album collection was really popular with kids my age because you didn't get all the Beatles records, but you got a big swath.
Yeah.
Of both eras. And I remember, and they used this picture of them from the mop top, and then the blue album inside was them in the same place. It was like was it the office, and they're all looking over the rail, but now they're hippies.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that was going to be the front cover of Get Back originally, which would have been the best album. What an album cover that would have been.
Yeah, right? Get Back. I've met two of the Beatles, and I've met...
Have you?
One of the Monkees? Two of the Monkees. Paul was at... My good mate, Neil Malachi, was in a double act with Mike Myers. So Mike wrote all the Wayne's World movies. And the second one, he has relatives from Liverpool. So I guess because he's a partial Scouse, they did a thing where Paul... There was a benefit for Paul's music academy or oratory or whatever it was.
Oh, Lipper.
Yeah. This was in the 90s. And so they showed Wayne's World 2 at the Lyceum or the Odeon in Leicester Square. And then we all repaired, you're going to love this, to the Hard Rock. So Paul McCartney was at an event at the Hard Rock with Linda, and neither of them would eat hamburgers, right? I mean, you know, the place is famous basically as a hamburger joint.
It's right.
So they had
track,
like vegan burgers. Yeah, it was great. It was great. So Paul Merton was over talking to Paul McCartney, and, I said, this is our chance, right? So let's move over there in a pincer motion to get to Paul McCartney. So we all pitch up, and he turns to me and he goes, oh, right, mate, so funny. Love the show, you know, da da da. And then he turns to Richard, the keyboard player, who is my best friend, Richard of Raunch. He was on Whose Line to Play the Keyboard. And he's also a complete, you know, waste. And so we've been best friends for 30 years, you know, and he's a huge Beatles fan, right? So Paul McCartney turns to Richard and goes, oh, you, mate, with the keyboard and the guitar, bloody marvelous, mate, bloody marvelous. And Richard goes, excuse me for a minute, and walks away. So we talk to Paul for a few more minutes, and he won't let us talk about the Beatles or him. He only compliments us, and we have a nice conversation. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's a party, so, okay, fuck off, you know. So we do. And Richard's in the corner with a pint, right? In the corner with a pint like this. And I go, what was that about? And he goes, how do you tell someone they've influenced your life since you were 6 years old? And I go, you don't. You don't tell them. I go, you think Paul McCartney doesn't know when a group of people come up to him that what we think of him? I mean, like, really? So that was how I met him. And then I'm friends with Craig Ferguson, or as we know him here, Fergie, who used to have a chat show for like 10 years on CBS. And because Craig and I are friendly, he had me on the show a bunch of times. And he had Ringo on one night just to do numbers, right? Like a really good episode. Mm. Because Craig was a good host and listened. He had a chat with Ringo, and then Ringo got up and played for like 30 minutes.
Really?
I mean, it was. So Brent invited me, and he goes, show up at TV City, which is the name of the studio, Television City, right? And at such and such a time. So I did. And Ringo comes out, and we chat, and there's other people there, a photographer, another musician named Ray Wiley Lewis, who's a country star, and the photographer, Rob, who's really awesome. His name's Rob Shanahan. So he took a picture of me and Ringo, and there's another person in the picture with me, and I fucking chopped them out. So the picture's of me and Ringo, and we're going like this. We're both laughing, and we're both wearing black suits.
Yeah.
And it looks like we are the best friends in the world. So that's how I met him, and I literally cropped my friend right out of the photo so that it would be the two of us sharing a laugh together. So when it's Ringo's birthday, like, I'll put that picture up on Twitter and be like, right, my old mate Ringo.
Having a bit of us time.
Yeah, it's just laughing it up. It's so great if you get a random photo like that. We are both bent over laughing. Or I think I'm thrown back and he's bent over. And and that we're both hilariously in black suits, like we're in a group together. Yeah. You know? So I don't know him, and I met him once, and then I watched them rehearse, and they played Boys, and they played the other giant Ringo early Beatles classic.
I Want to Be Your Man.
Yeah, I Want to Be Your Man. Thank you.
Oh,
they,
wow.
Yeah. So they ran through those a bunch of times, and so I stayed for all of them.
Yeah.
Because Ringo's mates with everybody.
Yeah.
Like Joe Walsh is in his band. Richard Marx is in, like, everybody plays with Ringo. Everybody. Mm. And when he was on tour, he'd take everybody, like Colin Hay. I'm friends with Colin Hay, so Colin Hay had been on tour with him. And said, private jet waiting when the show's over, taken in a car from the stadium before the traffic's allowed out, down to the tarmac to the private jet, get on the jet, lobster rolls. And Ringo turned to him and go, not bad, eh, Cole? And then another good story is Brett went with him to the Today Show. And the Today Show always has, it's a morning crap show. It's a morning show in New York. I'm sure you've heard of it.
Yeah.
It's been running 1,000 years. And one of their big deals before this containment was they had live bands play. Like, so Fleetwood Mac or Beyonce, whoever, to promote their tour, to promote their, to middle America, because it's a really mainstream, like all breakfast shows. It's so mainstream. Yeah. So they're going to have Ringo on. And they get there, and he's got the band with him, right? And he says, the producer says to him, do you mind if we cut the song down?
Yeah.
You know, if you miss a couple verses or whatever. I think he was going to do a little help for my friends or something.
How did,
and Ringo
that go
goes,
down?
Right. Oh, he right. Leaves. They get back in the car, the whole band, and they're driving away, and Ringo turns to my buddy and goes, what am I, Johnny Nobody and the fuck, or, you know, whatever? What the fuck? No, I'm not cutting the fucking song down. Fuck you. And I love that. So
yeah.
You know, because he's always peace and love, peace and love. And they just had a birthday here, and he was on the Grammys the other night.
Yeah.
He looks great, and, you know, he's really nice and friendly, and he doesn't shake hands. He goes, like that.
Yes, I've heard that. I've heard.
So we elbow bumped when I met him.
Way before any of this, he was doing that as well.
Way before. Him and Howie Mandel pioneered that. They just didn't want to touch people, man, and I can understand it. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we're all going to stop shaking hands for a couple of years. So.
Yeah. I'm stopping shaking everything.
So that's my two Beatles stories. Never met George, never met John. Rick Overton had a good story about meeting John in a store in New York. He didn't really meet him. He was just in the same store in the 70s. And Yoko was with John. And John went over to, like, get a candy bar or something. And Yoko went, John. And
really?
He said they caught eyes. And John went, you know.
Ah, interesting. Have you heard, which you will know from your time over in the UK, Q Magazine?
Oh, yeah, very much so.
There's an interview which someone's uploaded on YouTube, an interview Paul did in 1986, and it's the most candid interview you will ever hear.
Looking back on it, I think we were okay. We were never really that mean to him. I think a lot of the time, John suspected meanness where it wasn't really there.
Oh, he's presumably very paranoid.
I think so. I mean, he warned me off Yoko once. You know, look, this was my chick, you know, just because he knew my reputation. I mean, we knew each other rather well. And I felt, well, I just kind of said, yeah, no problem. But, I mean, I sort of did feel he ought to have known I wouldn't. He was going through, I'm just a jealous guy. He was a paranoid guy. And he was into drugs, heavy. Yeah.
But yeah, there's have a listen. If you just Google Q 1986 Paul McCartney, it'll blow that your head good. Off. It's an amazing.
There was a new reappraisal of him in a music magazine here a couple months ago that I thought was really, really good. That kind of approached him with a different angle and like stop saying he's the chirpy one. He's done a bunch of stuff. And stop saying everything that wasn't in the Beatles was shitty, you know. And it's like, I think it's time to reappraise him. He's 80. He deserves it, you know. The Peter Jackson movie's coming out, and that looks really good.
Yes.
And they were both saying, Ringo and Paul, that it's a little more, like, realistic because they filmed the whole making of the record, and they're not fighting the whole time. They're laughing, they're smoking, they're goofing, they're getting high, they're drinking tea, they're riffing, there's other people in, like... It's not, they weren't just screaming at each other. It's always that, just suddenly, what's the plan? I'll play, you know, that vibe. And they're like, actually, no, we kind of, they were best mates.
One of the few benefits of the first lockdown in the UK, I listened to every single Let It Be outtake that's out there. And I've said this in a few podcasts, but I'd say a good 90% of it, they're having a great time. And everybody bases it on the film, because the film is so depressing.
I watched this Ron Howard thing that was about the early days. I don't know if you've ever seen this one.
Oh, 8 days a week.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. And I thought some of the people they interviewed were highly irrelevant. But I also thought that the interviews with the Beatles, there was a couple things that I never knew. And one of them was that all of the decisions were made by all of them, that there was no one was the leader. They literally had to all sign off on whatever they were going to do. And then they did it. They didn't just fucking sign up for movies and then what? I'm in a movie like they. And I thought that is so great that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's Liverpool or that being Northern or that they weren't in regular London show business right away or that they just did that from the start or whatever they did, because.
Yeah.
As my wife said to me after we watched it, she said, the reason why they're so great is they stop being a group at a certain point and they never tried to do it again. They're perfect in that they stopped. They did the right thing. Yeah. And then they all decided, no, let's not do it again. Let's not.
Yeah.
I mean, they roomed together. Dig that. They didn't have four separate rooms on the road.
Yes. Yeah.
Ringo roomed with John and George roomed with Paul. I mean, like, what? That's when they were touring, and they were the biggest thing in the world.
Yeah. If you've ever done that, even with your best friend, it's not great.
I'm in a group with four guys, and we don't stay together. We have, but not as much as we want to. It's a bummer.
Yeah.
I just can't get over that, though.
Yeah.
They had such a small staff. That's what I couldn't get over. That's it's like how few people were running this ship.
It was basically Brian, Mal Evans, Neil Aspinall, and that was pretty well it.
Who's the good-looking one? It was George's best mate.
Oh, Derek Taylor.
Yeah, Derek, yes. Taylor. The one who looked like he's a Beatle.
He did, yeah.
Yourself.
When you were growing up in the 60s, you would have grown up with the US albums.
Yes, and they're much different. Revolver, there's a bunch of different tracks. Only when I got the CD thing years ago as a gift, then I had all the British ones proper, with the British covers and everything.
Mm.
And when we were little, you had to buy them as imports. And the one with the chopped meat cover was banned here somehow or whatever. Is that Yesterday and Today?
Yeah.
And that was an album cover they liked because they thought it was a comment on what was going on in their lives. And that got snubbed. And I can't remember what picture they use here. But so I did. Yeah, I grew up with those. And then Beatles for Sale is called something else here.
Whoa.
With the Beatles or something? No.
You've got a choice because there was a few. There was Beatles 65.
Yeah, Beatles 65.
Beatles 6, which had both.
So when I lived in San Francisco on my own, I had Beatles 65 because it has... It happened once before when I came to your door. That's how it starts.
Yeah.
Now we fly. That's how you with him and my place. I nearly died. Last time the world was happening, we went to visit our very good friend, Jim Sweeney, and he's a hilarious improviser. He's in care because he has MS. And we played 4 or 5 Beatles albums in a row, and it was Beatles 65. And we played that one. We played the other one where they're stoned on the cover. It's green.
Rubber Soul?
Rubber Soul. And Revolver, like that era.
Yeah.
And he was talking about, like, they're only a few albums into it at this point, and they're such great songwriters already, and they're still doing covers. Like, Kansas City's on, you know, and Buddy Holly and stuff. Like, they're doing other people's numbers still. They're padding out their album with covers, and then they quit doing that, you know, eventually. But, like, he's like, they're still doing that on this album, and they're monstrous. They're so great. So, yeah, I did. So that was weird, getting in that configuration.
So were you, I'm guessing you were too young at the time, but when did you realize that the UK and US albums were completely different for the first few years?
That's why I bring up my friend Jeff, because Jeff and I were little kids together. He was a little older than me, and he had a couple of the Beatles albums, and then he told me that there was another one, and I think he might have even had a copy of the one with the cut-up meat thing that he had procured. You know, you had to order them. You know, you'd go to the, even when I was a teenager, if you really wanted a special record from an import, we always called them, the English version of stuff was always better and had more stuff. And so you would or go to the record store and order the English one, and then it would come. So you could obtain them. Kind of with hilariously how the Beatles, the reverse of what the Beatles and Stones did, which was go to Europe, buy imports, or go to Liverpool, such an international town. And also then they came to America, they bought a bunch of records and they brought them back, you know, so they, there was always that constant flow of, but it was going toward England then. Like, isn't the origin story of Mick and Keith that they were on a train together and Keith happened to have a bunch of like Little Richard and shit. And Mick was like, wait a minute, you know?
Yeah.
I like your taste, you know, like, and then they went home and spun a bunch of records. This is when they're kids.
Yeah.
And that's how they became friends. Like, they liked American records, which you had to go get.
The Stones' US albums are even more confusing than the Beatles' albums.
Right?
There's hundreds
of them. I have no
idea
why they did that. Why did they do that?
Alan Klein, there's all these, from it.
Yeah. There's all these weird collections, too, here that the Stones did, even in the 60s.
Oh, Flowers.
There's a couple of compilations that everybody had. One was called Glazed Cookies or something, and... And that had a bunch of the psychedelic hits on it. And then there was another one that was earlier that had I Used to Love Her and got like the early hits on it.
Yeah.
And then they put out a couple really weird compilations, one called Sucking Up the 70s. And,
yes.
You know,
yeah, that was for a tour.
I've seen them 1,000 times. My wife is a very big Stones fan.
Very briefly, if you had to pick one album, what would it be?
I can't. I would have said at one point the White Album, and then I'm awfully fond of Abbey Road because I think they did the right thing. When you don't have fully fleshed out numbers, put them all together and make it a symphony, which they did. But I think Revolver, because it anticipates all the psychedelia, which I really love the psychedelia. I love Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields and all the tripped out ones, but I know Penny Lane doesn't seem like a psychedelic one, but it is kind of a psychedelic. There's the weird shifting in it, and the horn part's really weird, and the lyrics are surreal. But Revolver, because George gets a shot finally and has a couple great numbers on it, and John's already Tomorrow Never Knows and whatnot is so groovy. So I think that one, I think Revolver anticipates a lot, and it is not cloying at any point. And it's got For No One Here and Good Day Sunshine. And yeah, She Said, She Said. That one's wild. The British version has Dr. Robert and the American version didn't. But Dr. Robert, I think, is a really cynical, fantastic song.
Understandably.
Yeah. Stones manager, Luke Oldham, used to go to him in New York and said he was there at like 3 a.m. once in the early, this is when the Stones were already coming in, so it's probably 65, 66. Getting a B12 with amphetamine in it. And the next booth over was Alan J. Lerner, who wrote all of, you know, My Fair Lady. Yeah.
Really? Yeah. Can I use that?
it's in Andrew Lou Goldham's first book, which is called Stoned.
Oh, that's Andrew's fault then.
Yeah.
And in the end,
Overall, I mean, what do the Beatles mean to you?
Oh, I love them. I just think they're great fun. I think they're the yin to the Stones yang or whatever. If the Stones are about anger and possession and rocking out and drugs and all that, and they never talk about how much they love you, unless they're being ironic, like the song We Love You. Whereas the Beatles are always telling you how much they love you and need you. And I think that's what appeals to people. Certainly the emotion and the sincerity, they're funny. And that goes a long way with moving the plot along. Their movies are as delightful as their albums. The music in the movie supports the movies. I think they're the fact that they were all good actors, or passable actors, rather, and Ringo was actually the good actor.
Yeah.
Ringo has screen charisma, and
it does.
The others are kind of trying a little hard sometimes, but they're wonderful on film, too. They remind me of they never make me sad. You can be sad about the Beatles because you can think about their breakup and all the tragedy that happened after. But I don't think they miss a generation because every generation, they put out another compilation, like the number ones or whatever that horrible title of that one was called.
One.
And then on, yeah, that was, such, and then the iTunes, when they launched on iTunes, what, 5-7 years ago, that was another big hit.
Yeah.
So everywhere you went in Los Angeles, there was a poster of them when they're all in like 68, 69, they're all beardy and great looking and George is all hips. And you know, it's like, that goes a long way too. I think they're kind of whatever age you want them to be. And I think that the truth is they're all, even though they're all kind of cussed and intractable in their own way, they're all really liberal spirits. And that means the most to me. Like there's not a secret Nazi in the group. Like other groups, like, you know, that are huge and we won't name names. There's Nazis in the group and it's a drag. It's a drag, you know, and the Beatles didn't do that. And they carried on not doing it. Paul and Ringo are still not like that. They didn't get older and richer and go, I'm a Nazi now. No. They just didn't. And the Beatles were never like that. And I think that's beautiful. I mean, the Stones aren't either, but the Beatles really didn't. And that peace and love thing wasn't a lie. Like John really lived it. You know, George went on to be friendly with comedians. And I know a couple of the comedians that he was friendly with and I've met them. And, so it's kind of exciting. It's profound. Like the Catholicity of George's taste, the, sheer bravura that like Paul keeps going after 1,000 years and makes a new album, like every other year. Still Ringo taking all stars on the road forever to have a fun party tour every year. I don't think any, and John being an amazing political force and feminist and ex sort of violence against women guy to being actually arch feminist to pointing out women's place in society, to using the frankest possible terms to do that over and over again, to talk about the class struggle, to have to refute the yippies and all the people that wanted him to do, that wanted to do violence in sort of the name of peace and love in the early 70s. There's an interview with him where he's like, they call me and they said they're going to like blow up the Republican convention. And he's like, I don't want to talk to you. You know, like, no, I'm not taking part in blowing up the Republican National Convention. Like, you're crazy, right? And so I feel like he was able to use his platform of rockitude and fame. Just the act of marrying an artist of Yoko's stature and telling everybody that you're in love with her all the time was radical. And it really, the world needed to happen. It needed, of course, the world's been shitty about it ever since. But I mean, I think she's gained some ground in the last few years. People are like, she's a great artist. He didn't just marry nobody. He married like a superb artist who deigned basically to marry a musician.
Oh, completely. Yeah.
And he wasn't particularly as enlightened as he became. You know, I think without her, he doesn't become the John Lennon that we all think of.
Yeah.
The one who goes to Watergate with his head shaved, the one who stays in bed in Amsterdam, the one who promotes human rights constantly and talks about metaphysics and why are we here and what is the meaning of your life and what are you doing with yourself. The other Beatles weren't as quite as reflective, and some George, I guess, but so that's sort of what the profundity of the Beatles music, but their philosophy was not lost on me. And not a lot of groups went out of their way to be like that. Not how many rock stars went out of their way to say like women are being treated poorly.
Not the Stones.
No, not the Stones.
I'm trying to think of the song where they did. Well, Greg, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you've got a lot going on at the moment.
Cheers, Chris. Thanks so much for having me on. I have to jump off, but I really had a good time talking about the Beatles.
All the best.
And I wish you lots of luck. I want you to be safe, mate.
And you. Enjoy. Take care.
Okay, bye.